The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show, sponsored by Legacy Precious Metals. There's never been a better time to invest in precious metals. Visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Every now and again, we have a subject that is so fascinating to me, I really don't know where to begin. It's almost like let me start here. Most of us don't think about things like, what was the world's first alphabet, and how is an alphabet different from written language? Hieroglyphics, Egyptian hieroglyphics, that's not an alphabet. The way the Chinese write with characters, that's not an alphabet. When was the first alphabet invented with letters and sounds? And it opens up a whole fascinating world. And recently, it came to my attention again because I realized that there's a man, Dr. Douglas Petrovich in Texas, who teaches biblical studies in ancient Near Eastern history and archaeology at the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas. And he's written a couple of books that purport to have discovered that the first alphabet in the history of the world is Hebrew. This is, the more you learn about this, the more fascinating and strange and amazing it is. He has a new book out, Dr. Petrovich, called Origins of the Hebrews, New Evidence of Israelites in Egypt from Joseph to the Exodus. A previous book is called The World's Oldest Alphabet. Douglas Petrovich, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be with you today.
I am really so fascinated by this. How do we start? I mean, if somebody knows nothing about this, and most people really don't think about this kind of thing, if somebody had asked the question 10 or 20 years ago of some scholar, hey, what's the first alphabet? What would they have said?
Well, they would have said it's clearly a Semitic language that's behind it. And so all scholars agree with that. And it's clearly a script that evolved or derived from Egyptian hieroglyphics. So there's clearly a physical visual basis or foundation in hieroglyphics. Everybody would agree on that. The question would just be, which is the Semitic language behind the world's
alphabet? All right. So see, I've just learned something already. So you're telling me that we know, and everybody would agree, that whatever the first alphabet was, the first written language that uses alphabetics, was derived, we know, from Egyptian hieroglyphics. Now, is that because of, is it the letter A that looks like a bull or an upside down bull? How do we know that Egyptian hieroglyphics lead to the first alphabet?
Well, we know for several reasons, one of which is that in its earliest form, and by the way, the earliest inscriptions were found at several sites in Egypt and several sites in Sinai, southwestern Sinai. So from those early inscriptions, we know that at that stage, at that phase, the alphabetic script was extremely what we call pictographic, which means it's as if you were drawing something and anyone looking at the drawing could clearly tell what you were drawing because of the picture. So that is what was borrowed very clearly and again agreed on by all scholars that was drawn from hieroglyphics. And as time went along, Eric, in the second millennium BC, and by the way, that's the 19th century BC is when it started. Our earliest attested alphabetic letter is 1842 BC, and the oldest inscription is 1840 BC. So as then time went along, the script evolved, if you don't mind the term, in such a way that it became less and less pictographic. And if you think about it, that's really logical, because you wouldn't want people to spend so much time writing every single letter, drawing a well, you know, with good curvature, all of the forms of a picture. But if you could make it more abstract, if you could write it faster, then it would speed up the entire writing enterprise.
Now the headline here, and I should have started with this, is that, I mean, this is so fascinating. It's always the more fascinating something is, the more difficult it is to sum up. But this has tremendous implications with regard to the historicity of the scriptures, the stories of Joseph. Again, going way back, talking to the 19th century BC. It's amazing, the 19th century BC, so far back, the time when Joseph would have lived. But we didn't really know this until fairly recently, and you've been at the forefront of showing this. There are a lot of directions to go in, but I think, isn't that the most controversial aspect of what you're putting out there, that there are people that just don't want to believe that some of what the Bible says is true, that's it's history? And by discovering this language, this alphabet, I should say, so far back, long before we thought there was an alphabet, you make it difficult for those who don't like to believe that the Bible is history.
Absolutely, Eric. And you would not believe the amount of flack that I have received in light of all of this, because it is giving credence to the historicity of the Bible. And if you think about it, and I don't know, you know, your academic background, but in most colleges and universities, both across the United States and around the world, professors have been using their platform to kind of mock the historicity of the Bible. And one of the greatest mockeries that's used is, hey, the Bible says the Israelites were in Egypt for 430 years. Why do we have no proof of that? And for all of this period of, you know, modern history with archaeology and with the study of ancient inscriptions, epigraphy, we have no examples that show us that the Israelites were there. And that then becomes a springboard to creating disbelief within our kids and our grandkids.
Okay, so what you're saying, though, is that we do have proof, specifically the evolution of written language from Egyptian hieroglyphics into what becomes Hebrew.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, so this is a huge deal. When did this become manifest? Was it when you came out with your book in 2017, The World's Oldest Alphabet? When does this bomb explode, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Great question. First of all, I will go back to the 1920s. There was a German scholar named Hubert Grimme, and Grimme was very much before his time, and he suggested first that the oldest alphabet, again, in these inscriptions in Egypt and Sinai, this oldest alphabet is actually Hebrew. And he was ostracized. He was kicked out of the academy. He was humiliated. And the reality is that he didn't get everything right. He identified some letters correctly. He didn't identify some letters correctly. And some of his translations were definitely suspect. So basically, the baby was thrown out with the bathwater, though, because not only is he right wrong about certain translations, but since he's wrong, then we can conclude that the thesis is wrong, that Hebrew isn't that old a script. So really, he was my predecessor in that. So I'm not the first ever to do this. But now, since his time, from then until now, the more studies that have been done on the oldest alphabet have demonstrated that we can identify more carefully, more accurately, a certain number of those letters, those pictographic letters that we weren't really sure what was the sound behind it. Is it a g? Is it a r? Is it a s? Is it a t? So my work was to kind of solidify the questionable, the debated values, you know, the consonantal values. So so my work really is groundbreaking in that sense, in being able to identify with confidence those letters.
Okay, we're going to go to a break. Folks, I'm talking to Douglas Petrovich, the world's oldest alphabet. This is huge stuff. Stick around.
Tell me, Eric, why is Relief Factor so successful at lowering or eliminating pain? I'm often asked that question. The owners of Relief Factor tell me they believe our bodies were designed to heal. That's right, designed to heal, and I agree with them. So the doctors who formulated Relief Factor for them selected the four best ingredients, yes, 100% drug-free ingredients. Each helps your body deal with inflammation. Each of the four ingredients deals with inflammation from a different metabolic pathway. And that right there, approaching from four different angles, may be why so many people find such wonderful relief. So if you've got back pain, shoulder, neck, hip, knee, or foot pain from exercise or just getting older, you should order the three-week quick start discounted to only $19.95 to see if it will work for you. It works for me. It has for about 70% of the 500,000 people who've tried it and have ordered more. Go to relieffactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF to find out about this offer. Feel the difference.
The fight for the unborn is raging in our country. An unprecedented leak from the Supreme Court indicates that Roe v. Wade is on the brink of being overturned. During this critical time, a new movie is about to be released. The award-winning film, The Matter of Life, cuts through the rhetoric and hatred and exposes the real issues surrounding the plight of the unborn. The Matter of Life will be in theaters nationwide for two nights only, May 16th and 17th. If you care about protecting the unborn, this is a movie you'll not want to miss. Go to Fathom Events. .com now to reserve your tickets for a theater near you for May 16th or May 17th and have your own life transformed as you watch The Matter of Life. That's Fathom, F-A-T-H-O-M, events.com, fathomevents.com. There is a battle, folks. It's taking place in America. Whether you're pro-choice or pro-life, you need to see this film. The Matter of Life is the film, May 16th and May 17th. Go to fathomevents.com right now, fathomevents.com. Folks, welcome back. I'm talking to Dr. Douglas Petrovich, who is putting forward a thesis with a lot of evidence that, in fact, the world's oldest alphabet is Hebrew, or what eventually became the Hebrew alphabet, going back so far that it's almost incomprehensible to the 19th century BC. If you know anything about the evolution of language and alphabet, and we're going to get into that, it's gigantic news, and it proves the link between Egypt and the Hebrew people. So a lot of what you discovered, Dr. Petrovich, and by the way, thank you for being with us today. The reason it's so controversial is because it supports the Bible as history, and there are a lot of people deeply invested in that not being right. And so you become their enemy, and what you're putting out there, they want to debunk it. When did you, in the course of your studies, begin to see that you had something here, that you could make this case?
It goes back to 2012 and 2013. It all started when I was studying for my comprehensive exams for my PhD at the University of Toronto, which, by the way, the major of my program was Syro-Palestinian archaeology, and the first minor was Egyptian language, ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic language. And then the second minor is ancient Near Eastern religions. But it all goes back to 2012, when all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I fell into evidence for Israelites in Egypt at the time of the Exodus. I already knew the right time frame for this, that it's the middle of the 15th century BC, that the Exodus happened in 1446 BC. And I knew the right place. which is the site of Avaris. And what was discovered there were animal remains consisting of four different animals that you read about in Exodus 11 and 12, the time of the first Passover, the 10th plague on Egypt, dogs, cattle, sheep, and goats. And most of them were sheep and goats, and almost all of the sheep and goats died in their first year of age, which is exactly what the Hebrew Bible says was a requirement for the sacrificial animals. So in studying this and in falling into this, you know, I consider it kind of like a gold mine that I fell into. This just led to more and more study, research questions. Well, if this is evidence of Israelites in Egypt, and they were there for 430 years, shouldn't there be some more evidence about them that can be verified and can confirm
the
story?
Okay, so again, for my audience, so literally until 10 minutes ago, 2012-13, we didn't have this kind of evidence. In other words, we know what the Bible says. We're trying to puzzle it out. But you're saying suddenly we find evidence – obviously animal remains that corroborates the idea that there were Hebrews there, because this is what they did with their animals. It's anomalous. You don't expect to find this. So when you find it, you go, well, this is weird. Why did all these animals die in around the first year? And you're saying, aha, it's because this is what the Hebrews would do.
Exactly. And I already knew who was the Exodus Pharaoh. In 2006, I published an article that's to date, as far as I know, the most detailed study ever done on identifying the Exodus Pharaoh. And that is Amenhotep II. He's the only one who fits all of the measurable biographical requirements that are found in the Bible. So I knew the right time frame. And it just happens, Eric, that with these burials, the very little pottery that was connected with them is pottery that can be dated to the reigns of Thutmose III, the father of Amenhotep II, and Amenhotep II himself. So it's tied in chronologically perfectly. So I knew that, you know, this is the right connection.
Well, okay, so there's a lot here, and I want my audience to be tracking with this, because this is we're talking about so many different disciplines. It makes it complicated, obviously. But so so liberal scholars who say the Bible is nonsense, they say, look, there is no evidence of the Hebrew of the Israelites being in Egypt. So you're saying you find evidence from the animals first. Now, again, if we said 30 years ago, 50 years ago, to some scholars who believe in the Bible, what is the evidence? Did they have any evidence at that point? How much of this evidence is really new?
A lot of it is fairly new, but a lot of it is not. And really, it comes back to this. Biblical scholars, and you use the term, that it requires a lot of disciplines. I'm interdisciplinarian, right? I have three master's degrees and a PhD, which makes me educated beyond my intelligence. But the point is, I've studied in the applicable fields, in the areas of specialization that would allow me to have the right training in all of these areas. And somebody couldn't have stumbled into all of this, Eric, unless you get the chronology of Israel right, you get the chronology of Egypt right, you synchronize the two correctly, and you have the ability to work with the textual evidence, you know, the writings, and with the archaeological evidence that comes out of the ground. So you have to have all of these disciplines behind you in order to stumble into this. And the problem was there really weren't people trained in enough and trained carefully enough in all of the right disciplines. That's the issue.
I mean, we see this actually happen again and again. I was interviewing recently a New Testament scholar, Eugenia Constantinou, who's in San Diego, who's written a book called The Crucifixion of the King of Glory. And because she has several master's degrees and she can look at things, she has a law degree, she looks at Roman law from the first century. And in a funny way, only if you have these different pieces can you pull things out. Other people wouldn't see it. So you have a number of master's degrees in these fields, and so you're able to see things that we've never seen before. But it must you know, it must be daunting in a sense to realize that you are seeing things that no one has seen for centuries, that people have debated or scoffed at, and that now you're bringing the evidence to light.
Yeah, and Eric, I can tell you this. This wasn't just an academic experience for me. For me, it was very emotional, very spiritual, and there were times where, you know, with one discovery after another, finding Jacob in the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, finding Joseph in ancient hieroglyphics, finding Joseph's two sons in ancient hieroglyphics, and all of this is in my new book, Origins of the Hebrews. But with one discovery after the next, here I am alone in Toronto at my house, and I would just stop what I was doing and weep because I couldn't believe that God would take the chief of sinners, the least of all the saints, and use him to be the vehicle through which God would reveal this to the world for the first time in over 3,450 years. Why me?
That's the best question. And I think that's what qualifies you, is the sense of your own unworthiness. God can work with people like that. And so here you are now. You know, it's kind of an amazing thing for any of us to be alive at a time when these things are coming to light. This is a big deal. So I want to walk with you through all of this stuff. You just mentioned in the new book, Origins of the Hebrews, that you found in Egyptian hieroglyphics, I think you just said, evidence of Joseph. I mean, this is astonishing. Tell us about that, because it's, that is astonishing. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, let me give you a couple kernels here. First of all, every Egyptian pharaoh had at least five names. This is called the royal titulary, the royal set of titles, if you will. And so they had five official names. So having lots of names is not a problem. And of course, Abraham had two names. Jacob had two names. Sarah had two names. And we know in the Bible that Joseph had two names. Well, he had other names that I discovered, Egyptian names. And it's very complicated. It would take me a lot of time to go through it. But here's kind of the best part of it. One of the names that he was given is Horus is at the forefront. Horus is the name of the falcon god in the Egyptian pantheon. And at this time, you know, now that Cyrus, again, according to Egyptian mythology, now that Cyrus, the king of the gods, had died, his son Horus took over. So Horus was now the king of the gods. And so that association for Egyptians is really important, because the king of the gods, I mean, he's the big deal. He's the big cheese. So Joseph is given a name, which is the king of the gods is at the forefront. What's the significance of that? Think about this. When Joseph was about to interpret the two dreams for the king of Egypt, right? He was brought out of the dungeon, and, you know, he was in jail. His hair was long. He had probably had a long beard. He was stinking. They cleaned him up, they shaved him, and they put him in front of the king. And before he even heard the dreams from the king, do you know what he said? He said this: "It is beyond me. God will give to Pharaoh a favorable answer." That's amazing.
Now hang on, we're gonna go to a break. This is called a cliffhanger in show business. We'll be right back. In case you haven't been paying attention, the Biden administration has caused a financial crisis, and they have no clue how to fix it. Oil prices have skyrocketed, and when oil prices go up, the cost of transportation and shipping spikes, leading the prices of goods to rise. And when we're already seeing record inflation, that's the last thing we need. Our economy is in trouble, and you need to take steps to protect yourself. If all your money is tied up in stocks, bonds, and traditional markets, you are vulnerable. Gold is one of the best ways to protect your retirement. No matter what happens, you own your gold. It is real. It is physical. It's always been valuable since the dawn of time. Legacy Precious Metals is the company I trust for investing in gold. They can help you roll your retirement account into a gold-backed IRA where you still own the physical gold. They can also ship gold and precious metals safely and securely to your house. Call Legacy at 866-528-1903 or visit them online at legacypminvestments.com.
Hey there, folks. Eric Metaxas here.
I know you know how much I love Mike Lindell and MyPillow. Well, Mike Lindell and MyPillow right now are offering a BOGO extravaganza. BOGO, buy one, get one. BOGO extravaganza on multiple MyPillow products. Now's the time to join the millions of Americans who've changed the quality of their sleep with MyPillow. Right now, you get the buy one, get one free special. MyPillow bed sheets, Giza Elegance My Pillows, the six-piece towel sets, and the roll-and-go anywhere My Pillows. Just go to the Radio Listener Specials page at MyPillow.com. Use the promo code ERIC. That's the Radio Listener Specials page at MyPillow.com. Use the code ERIC or call 1-800-978-3057, 1-800-978-3057. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to buy one, get one free on select products. You'll also receive Mike's book absolutely free. You won't believe it. It's amazing. 800-978-3057 or MyPillow.com. Use the code ERIC.
Tell me, Eric, why is Relief Factor so successful at lowering or eliminating pain? I'm often asked that question. The owners of Relief Factor tell me they believe our bodies were designed to heal. That's right, designed to heal. And I agree with them. So the doctors who formulated Relief Factor for them selected the four best ingredients. Yes, 100% drug-free ingredients. Each helps your body deal with inflammation. Each of the four ingredients deals with inflammation from a different metabolic pathway. And that right there, approaching from four different angles, may be why so many people find such wonderful relief. So if you've got back pain, shoulder, neck, hip, knee, or foot pain from exercise or just getting older, you should order the three-week quick start discounted to only $19.95 to see if it will work for you. It works for me. It has for about 70% of the 500,000 people who've tried it and have ordered more. Go to relieffactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF to find out about this offer. Feel the difference.
Folks, I'm talking to Dr. Douglas Petrovich. This is an astonishing subject. I hope you've been listening. Dr. Petrovich, you were just telling us that you found evidence. And again, this is just, this is so big. We got to unpack it. We need the time. But you find evidence from Egyptian hieroglyphics of Joseph from the Bible. And you were just telling us about one of his names, which is not found in Scripture. It's found, according to you, in the Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and that's the name. Horus is at the forefront, and Horus is the king of the gods. So the king of the gods is at the forefront. And as I was mentioning before the break, Joseph was about to give the interpretation of the dream. He hadn't heard the dreams yet, the two dreams that the king provided him, or was about to provide him with. He hadn't heard them yet. And before he does, and he knows, what does he do? He's a dream interpreter. He knows full well he's going to interpret these dreams for the king. But before he hears the dream, the two dreams, he says this. He says to the king, it is not in me. In other words, there's no way I can answer this, the interpretation of this dream. But God will give to the king, to Pharaoh, a favorable answer. So what he does is he gives the credit for the soon-to-be interpretation to God rather than himself. So what does he do? He puts God at the forefront rather than Joseph at the forefront.
Okay, now, obviously, some people would say, well, God, it's not God, it's Horus. When we say Horus, the eye of Horus is that kind of floating eye above the pyramid that we have on the back of our dollar bills, the eye of Horus. But you're saying that Joseph, when he says this, he means God. He doesn't mean, it's an interesting thing because we're talking about Joseph, so we kind of assume that he's being theologically orthodox, being, after all, the patriarch Joseph. But it's interesting that he would put Horus in that position.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Eric. Back in this time period, and in the ancient Near East, you didn't receive your name at birth. You received a name when something distinguished you as being worthy of that name or being connected to some
kind
event.
Kind of like man who kills two bears.
Exactly. Something Native Americans. Like that. I mean, that's how they made names.
Right.
So it's other people who are assigning his name, and when they look at him and they hear him, they're seeing what he does, they're hearing what he says, and they say to themselves and they say to each other, wow, this guy's different. You know what he does? He puts the king of the gods at the forefront. And that's their terminology. So they're coming up with the name, not Joseph.
Amazing. So this is something, when did you discover this? When did you read this in Egyptian hieroglyphics?
This would have been toward the end of 2012 or early 2013.
And where are these hieroglyphics? In other words, we know that they're ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, 4,000 years old, but when did you see them? Where do they exist?
They're from different sites in Egypt mainly. Some inscriptions are at, very few, but some are at Avaris, the site where the Israelites settled. Others are at, for example, Dashur, which is where Joseph was first buried. He wasn't buried with his family at Avaris. He was buried as a vizier would be, a second in command in Egypt would be. He was buried in a massive, we would connect it with a mausoleum, it's called a mastaba, that's next to the pyramid of the king that he served.
And who is the pharaoh that he served?
That would be, well, Sesostris II of the 12th dynasty would have been the pharaoh of the abundance period, the 7 years of plenty. So I call him affectionately the abundance pharaoh. And then Sesostris III takes the throne literally in that transitional year, oddly enough, between the 7 years of abundance and the 7 years of famine. And so that's Sesostris III.
Okay, so scripture tells us that Joseph was the number two man to the pharaoh. It's an amazing thing. But as far as I know, we simply do not have extra biblical evidence of any of this. We're talking about something that happened in the mists of prehistory. For most people, they just say it's just legendary. It's stories in the Bible. So are you the first one to discover extra biblical evidence for Joseph?
Yes, there is nobody else who's done this before, Eric. This is a first.
This is monumental stuff. It's why I wanted to have you on the program. It's kind of amazing to me. There hasn't been more news about this. This is major, folks. This is so huge. I'm trying to unpack it myself right now as we're having the conversation. So in what context were you reading these hieroglyphics and that this leapt out at you? Were you, you know, at your home in Toronto with these texts in front of you? How did this come about?
Yeah, I was basically at home in Toronto. And of course, I was a student at the University of Toronto, which has a phenomenal library in ancient Near Eastern history and Egyptology. So I was able to get any of the resources that I needed. And so it was just following a trail because it all started with a research question. If we have evidence of Israelites in Egypt at the time of the Exodus, is there anything to show us that they would have been there for any other time period? And I just literally followed a trail. I mean, I was Hansel and Gretel on the trail, finding one piece of, you know, breadcrumb after another, and it just grew and grew and grew and grew, and it's all interconnected.
Which is what makes it a little bit difficult to explain. We're going to go to another break here. Folks, I'm talking to Douglas Petrovich, who has written at least two books. The new one is called Origins of the Hebrews, New Evidence of Israelites in Egypt, From Joseph to the Exodus. And then a few years ago, the book is The World's Oldest Alphabet, Hebrew as the Language of the Proto-Consonantal Script. We'll be right back with Dr. Douglas Petrovich.
Venture highway in the sunshine, where the days are longer, the nights are stronger than moonshine.
Folks, we're getting an educational seminar. I'm talking to Dr. Douglas Petrovich. This is so fascinating. It's unbelievably fascinating. Dr. Petrovich, you are telling us the story of how God allowed you to be the person to discover extra biblical evidence. I mean, this is astonishing. Linking Joseph and these early figures in the Hebrew Bible to extra-biblical evidence, to evidence outside the Bible, evidence in Egyptian hieroglyphics. And so at what point does the light bulb go off above your head? In other words, you, like me and like many scholars, you believe the Bible is history, but you know, at some point you think, well, Who knows what we will find? Maybe we won't find anything. Maybe some things I have to take on faith. I just know that the Bible is real, and I would be foolish to discount it. But every now and again, something far outside the Bible corroborates what's in the Bible. It's an astonishing thing. I've spoken quite a bit to Dr. Stephen Collins, who finds biblical Sodom. When you can find in archaeology evidence outside the Bible that points back to the historicity of the Bible, it's rather a big deal, obviously.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I'm convinced that God is the one who initiated all of this, right? It wasn't as if I was out looking for this, Eric. I didn't intend to be the person who finds evidence for Israelites in Egypt. I mean, that wasn't on my list of goals. I just wanted to study Egyptian hieroglyphics, study it well, learn it well, and be able to work with texts and see what's there and kind of just go on to a path of discovery. And it's God who ordained that I would stumble into all of this amazing evidence. And I'm still in awe that I was chosen.
Well, it's funny because I wrote a book this last year called Is Atheism Dead? And there's so much information in that book that I would find this information that had been discovered by people like you, and I would be amazed at it. But then I would be further amazed that I hadn't heard about it before, that it takes time for this information to be brought to light. What we're talking about here is headline news, but it's not in most headlines. The New York Times has not said, you know, scholar purports to discover blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's earth-shattering. It goes against the consensus. It goes against the theologically liberal consensus. And so it is controversial. There's so many pieces to this. What was the first piece for you? Because I want to talk about your discovery of Hebrew as the first alphabet. I want to talk about that. But we're talking about other stuff right now. Where did it begin for you? Was it when you were reading these hieroglyphics and you start noticing things that sound to you like it's Joseph and others from the patriarchal period?
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to there's a series or a set of inscriptions that tie together with one another to identify Joseph, to identify Ephraim, the son who is given the birthright from Jacob, and Manasseh in the archaeological record, and one of Manasseh's obscure sons that you only read about in Joshua chapter 17, verse 2. There's a list of his six sons, and there in that list is this little boy who shows up visually even in the form of a picture on an inscription from a site called Sirbit Echadim in Sinai. And so it's the combination of these connecting inscriptions and the identifications on them that really becomes powerful. And there's one inscription that I'll mention since you ask about, where did a major light bulb come on? There's one inscription that acts kind of as a conduit between the discovery of evidence for Israelites in Egypt and identifying Hebrew as the oldest alphabetic script. So there is an inscription. It's on a stela called Sinai 115 from Serabit, and it's about 9 feet tall. It looks like a tombstone, an oversized tombstone, and it has an inscription going all the way from top to bottom describing what happened during that year when this team went down to Serabit to extract turquoise because it was all about a lucrative industry to make money.
Okay. And this is this like the 19th century BC? What
yes.
Time is this?
Yes, this is the middle of the 19th century BC.
Okay, so this is a stele or stele, however it's pronounced.
Yeah, this is a stela.
A stela mm-hmm. recounting in Egyptian hieroglyphics something from 4,000 years ago with regard to mining turquoise, which was a big deal for millennia ago.
Mm-hmm. And one of the major players in this expedition was a man named Chebeded. It's a fascinating name because
what's the name
in Egyptian? Chebeded.
Gesundheit. What?
Chebeded.
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 Okay.
Chebeded. Mm-hmm. Starts with a guttural letter. And Chebeded, that name, Eric, is never used before or never used after this in any Egyptian records. Never, never, never. And the inscriptions that he wrote there make it clear that he's an Asiatic. Well, his name means, again, passive participle. It means he who was disfavored. And I identify Chebedad with Manasseh. What happened to Manasseh? When Joseph's two sons were standing before Jacob, when Jacob was almost ready to die, and Jacob decides, I'm going to give the birthright to the second-born son, not the first-born son. What happens to the first-born son?
He is dishonored.
He's dishonored. And that's the name of this guy named Chebedad. And he has a son, and it's written on one of the other inscriptions that he composes, named Shechem. Well, Shechem is the Egyptian equivalent of the Hebrew name Shechem, which you find in Joshua 17:2. Again, one of the six sons of Manasseh that's named there. So he becomes essentially kind of like the foundational stone in this entire structure, the identification of this obscure son of Manasseh. So one of the inscriptions, at the base of one of the inscriptions that on the stele, that Manasseh, as Chebedad, composes, he writes something in hieroglyphics as a caption to a picture that depicts him on top of a donkey, his son to our right as we're looking at it, and on the left it's an Egyptian attendant. And over the top of the heads of all of these people, he writes this caption. The caption reads, and I'll just give you the translation, six Levantines, meaning six people from the Levant. The Levant is ancient Canaan, ancient Phoenicia, and ancient Syria. Six Levantines, Hebrews of Bethel, the Beloved.
Holy cow. We go to another cliffhanger. Yeah. We'll be right back to hear the rest of that.
Hey there, folks. We are listening to the most amazing interview with Douglas Petrovich. Albin, are you listening to this guy?
This guy is unbelievable. I can't believe it.
Well, before I say more about Douglas Petrovich, a couple things. I got stranded in Colorado. So I'm at the Airport Hotel in Denver right now. I just want people to know the adventures of my life. I spoke the last few days. I've been in Colorado Springs with Pastor Steve Holt of the Road Church. And I don't know how to say this, but in New York, where you are, where my family is, it's been like 90 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here,
all weekend. Yeah.
Here in Denver. Well, not in Denver. I'm in Denver now, but in Colorado Springs, where I was, it was a blizzard. It was the weirdest thing. It was Pastor Steve Holt said we got 18 inches of snow in his backyard. This is north of Colorado Springs. It was so surreal being in the middle of snow and seeing snow everywhere. And then talking to Suzanne, who's like, yeah, it's 92 degrees here in New York. I said, this is just, it's kind of amazing. Well, that's the Rockies for you, as they say here. It's just totally different. Okay. I want to update people. I spoke at Sean Foyt did a Hold the Line conference with again, Pastor Steve Holt of the Road. Lauren Boebert spoke. Boebert. I've never heard Lauren Boebert speak at all. I really know nothing about her. I was so impressed. I was astonished, actually. She's about 35 and tiny, and she spoke. It was like the most fiery sermon speech I've ever heard. This woman is a profound Christian, profound. You can't fake that stuff. And I was just really impressed. And we're going to have her on this program. She's facing a bitter primary because when you're that good, the other side really hates you a lot. Oh, and yeah. So we're going to get her on this program. But I was just really, really thrilled, actually, really thrilled to hear her and to find out, like, hey, this woman is the real deal. Whatever they're saying about her, I've heard her speak and I'm just thrilled. So anyway, I want to mention that. I want to mention that this is our last week for CSI. Now, folks, you know, and I know that we're blessed to be a blessing. So whatever it is that you have, we're supposed to share it as we're able. The question is, with whom? Well, we vet organizations for you. CSI is, they're the best of the best. Right now, they're helping refugees in Ukraine. They need help. You know the story. It's horrifying having to leave your home. And so we're asking you to go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, MetaxasTalk.com, and click on the banner and give what you can. If there's anybody out there who's able to give $10,000, I just throw this out there. I'd be delighted to have dinner with you, spend the evening together with you. But we need everybody to give something. $140 is the amount they're asking. But whatever fraction of that you can give, whatever multiple of that you can give, the phone number is 888-253-3522, 888-253-3522. I also got to say, Albin, a lot of people are not signed up for my newsletter. They're getting the Salem newsletter, the Metaxas Talk newsletter, and they're getting this like every day. And I said, no, 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 no. I'm talking about my newsletter, ericmetaxas.com. I'm not talking about the Salem newsletter, which I think people are getting some video update every day. I'm talking about my newsletter. Folks, if you're not signed up for my newsletter, you got to go to ericmetaxas.com. Eric, not metaxastalk.com. That's the radio website. MetaxasTalk.com is a radio website. If you want to go to give to CSI, that's where you go. But my website is ericmetaxas.com. Sign up for my newsletter. I will be back with more. Stick around.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.